Howdy, and welcome to The Stoop. I'm Cutter Gonzalez, your host, and on this episode we have a very special guest who, along with her team, is celebrating a monumental win for making housing abundant in New York City. This is, of course, Anne-Marie Gray, the Executive Director of Open New York, New York's statewide grassroots pro-housing organization. Over the last 2 years, Anne-Marie has overseen the rapid growth of Open New York's work both within New York City and across the entire state. Prior to this role, she spent 3 years as Senior Policy Advisor in City Hall, where she oversaw land use and housing policy, including the rezonings of Soho, NoHo, and Gowanus, and the Where We Live NYC Fair Housing Plan, across two mayoral administrations under Deputy Mayor Vicky Bean and Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer. She previously worked for the New York City Economic Development Corporation and the Cambridge Housing Authority in Cambridge, Massachusetts. With Anne-Marie and the Open New York staff and volunteers' leadership and advocacy, New York City just passed City of Yes on December 5th, just 2 weeks ago. This is a huge step toward fixing the city's globally infamous housing crisis, which asks every single neighborhood to do their part to ensure New York lives up to the best of itself. I found quite a bit of resonance with the work I've been a part of here in Austin. For one, both of our cities have mythic reputations of sorts, though very different in scale and style. Both are only arguably accurate throughout our histories. But we draw on those high ideals to make them real now. Here, I hope we're building an Austin that is as loving, tolerant, and creative as we've been rumored to be. For New York, we can remember those famous, beautiful words emblazoned on the Statue of Liberty. It's that poem, The New Colossus, by Emma Lazarus. She says, "Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land. Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp," cries she with silent lips. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." These are words of hope and highest aspiration, plus a radical calling to be different from the rest of a world that closes its doors so often. It is a call to abundance, welcome, togetherness, and a resultant freedom. Truly, us at our best. Likewise, there are many, many lessons that transfer in more technical, if less poetic, ways. You'll hear about real negotiations in a tough political process, the long work of creating abundant housing, and so much more. I hope New York City is renewed as a place of hope, inspiration, and refuge for the entire world, and I know Anne-Marie's work is part of making that happen. Let's tune in and hear how. Hey, Anne-Marie. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great, sitting here in Austin enjoying the evening. How are you up in New York City?
Good. It's a little bit rainy, but closing out the year, getting ready for the holidays. So it's lovely here this time of year.
That's nice. Yeah, luckily we just finished a couple of days of rain and it's like bright and sunny, but I'm stuck inside all day. So I'm hoping after our call I can get some sunshine. I'm spoiled by that Texas sun. Not by the temperature, but it's 80 degrees here, so a little different, I'm sure. Well, I am so, so glad to have you on the podcast for a number of reasons. One, I just love Open New York, and I got to visit y'all a couple weeks back, and that was such a privilege to see where you do all the good stuff you do. And I love the city. It's been a dream of mine, or it was a dream of mine, to go to New York City for a long, long time from when I was real little, and then I finally got to go a couple years back, and I've been obsessed ever since, as everyone is who goes. And then professionally now, working in housing, y'all just did some really cool shit. So I want to talk about all of that, which came under the City of Yes banner. But before we do, I would love to talk to you about how you got started in this. Like, what was your story that led you to work in housing?
Yeah, well, I actually my official training was actually I went to architecture school, and then I went to planning and policy school, and just really start, I've been always just really interested and intrigued by the built environment and by, the physical space, and how that influences how we live and how society is structured. And the more and more I learned about housing, frankly, I just started to see where I grew up really differently, and frankly learned a lot about exclusionary zoning, learned a lot about like why certain neighborhoods look the way they do, why I had impressions of some places differently than others. And just really kind of went down the whole rabbit hole of how you get pretty radicalized around this stuff. And just really landed on, how sort of this the idea of this the housing theory of everything. If you care about climate, you care about transit, you care about health, care about racial justice. It's just, there's this through line of housing that's so important. And I had a slew of jobs in the public sector, actually. I worked for the Housing Authority in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I worked for the Economic Development Agency for New York City. And then I worked in City Hall for 3 years prior to taking over at Open New York. I was behind the scenes on the Soho NoHo and Gowanus rezonings and the Where We Live sort of fair housing plan, if that means anything to any listeners here. But I was land use advisor for Vicky Bean, the head of the Furman Center, when I was there, and just really got really just deeply invested in fair and more abundant housing and sort of the movement around it, and happened to meet a lot of Open New York members who, when they were turning out for the projects I was working on the inside, and was really excited to take the helm about 2 years ago and just kind of try to turbocharge all of the work and also grow it to focus not just on individual projects, but citywide policy such as City of Yes and increasingly statewide policy where the ticket really is. And fun tidbit, I actually helped seed the early the City of Yes as the concept at the beginning of the administration before I left. So this particular win has something I've been working on and with a lot of different hats on for a long time.
I love that. It feels like there's such a strong through line there. And that can be so different. Some activists were like in very different fields, and then they like found their way to housing. And then it always intrigues me, the architects who end up there. Like, it's not surprising in one sense, but it's beautiful. Where did you grow up? You mentioned that you saw where you grew up differently. I'm curious.
I grew up in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. It's funny, I grew up in Montgomery County, which is now also, nerd famous for like its social housing work, and it was actually the first place to do exclusionary zoning. So in the scheme of places, it's done a lot of things right, but it was a kind of classic upper middle class, single family neighborhood, and in a place that could distribute resources a lot better.
Yeah. Going back to where you grow up after being getting housing filled is a different thing, right? Like, I mean, I grew up half in Houston and then the other half in New Braunfels, just north of San Antonio. And New Braunfels doesn't have the same history that Houston and Austin, a bunch of others do with how they treated race. It was a different kind of thing with the German immigrant community there, but they living in Austin now, it's like the dividing lines are so clear and so severe, and that whole bit of exclusionary zoning, of deed restrictions, of the whole gamut of keeping people out of your communities was put to use here, as in the areas you mentioned. Some of us are probably, well, I'm obviously very familiar with Open New York because I work close with y'all on some things, or and Welcoming Neighbors Network does broadly. But could you tell us about what Open New York is and does? And first off, y'all are statewide, right? It's not New York City, it's Open New York.
It's Open New York. We cover the whole state. So we're a grassroots nonprofit organization. We advocate for, more housing of all kinds, from social housing and government subsidized housing to market rate housing, and as part of sort of an all of the above approach, but to how we actually solve our housing crisis. And we started, pretty informally with a grassroots members just showing up at their local community board meetings, and especially in some of the whitest, wealthiest neighborhoods of New York City that kept saying no, but they're in the middle of the best transit network in the country. And those hyperlocal meetings, as a lot of places in the country are really, really crucial for actually deciding where housing gets built. And then they so they you know they were a lot of those early members were really behind a couple key projects in the city, and then were really active in the Soho rezoning, which is where I got most familiar with them. And so since I took the helm, we still have we have, I think, 12 different chapters in total. We have probably almost 800 members at this point, that turn out locally to their and organize locally in their own communities. And then we have an increasingly, increasingly large staff that is especially working on, supporting our membership, supporting a lot of the grassroots organizing, but also starting to do a lot of more organized advocacy around the citywide proposal, such as City of Yes. And we're running our first state bill. We ran our first state bill last year and are starting to expand our state level chapters more deliberately, which is really, really exciting.
It's such important work. I think for a lot of us out here in the hinterlands of New York City, the rest of the country, I say that as an Austinite, it's a joke. But a lot of us think about New York and its towers and transit and that kind of thing. And it's hard to even imagine that zoning and parking minimums and all that kind of stuff exists in a place like that. Because it feels so different from somewhere like here, right? When was that always the case? And like, why was that introduced and why was it maintained? Is it maintained?
I think just like writ large of what you're saying, it is so funny about New York City. Everyone assumes like, oh, it's New York City. Like, it's all high rises, and you don't have these same challenges a lot of other places have. Again, we have still had parking mandates on the books, in a lot of parts of the city for a really long time. We actually, for the last decade, the per capita unit production was lower than San Francisco, which is famous for not building housing. We've only built like one new home for every three jobs in the last decade. Last year, the vacancy rate was we've got a big sort of update analysis on the New York's vacancy rate of 1.4%. So, and actually, some of the most centrally located parts of Manhattan are on net losing homes because you're seeing a lot of like conversions, especially in historic buildings, and not enough new construction. And when you look statewide, and especially even just region-wide, Westchester and Long Island, frankly, have some of the most exclusionary land use patterns in the nation, which is bad for those communities and also really exacerbates pressures in New York City. Frankly, the main release valve of why it's not worse is that New Jersey builds a lot of housing. And so New York City has a really long way to go, and there are whole swaths of the city that frankly are low density districts. And a lot of people point back especially to the 1961 zoning changes that sort of helped, and then especially some of the patterns of rezonings in the Bloomberg era, where we kind of just shrink wrapped the whole entire parts of the city. And we do have an as of right process in a way that a lot of other cities don't, but still a huge number of projects just still need to go through discretionary approvals, which, as they are in so many places, are very biased towards the status quo and very biased towards sort of hyperlocal voices that tend to be homeowner, frankly, tend to be whiter and wealthier, tend to not have kids, and tend to have the time to show up to hours and hours of meetings. So again, these are some of the same patterns that you see in a lot of other places that absolutely apply to New York. We have some more complicated systems of we have a big rent stabilization stock, we have there's we have state level tax credits, so we have other differences that other states don't necessarily have, but we also have not passed any really significant pieces of pro-housing legislation in the way that, we're sitting here at the end of 2024, a lot of states and cities have, and that's why City of Yes is so exciting, because it really is the first major pro-housing win that we've had in New York. And we have a long way to go, especially at the state level, where the state government has not actually stepped in any real way the way they have in other states.
Could you, for my own edification, break down what you meant buy right and discretionary processes just before we jump in on the City of Yes stuff?
Sure. I always assume it's a nerdy listening crowd, but yeah, buy right is just, if assuming a developer owns a piece of land, wants to build a building, assuming you're conforming to all the right regulations, you can go ahead and build it rather than any new building has to go through a discretionary process with whatever local government body oversees that, right? And so those are some crucial differences. And it's that discretionary process that is so often, upholding the status quo and not helping us build the homes that we need.
Yeah, I remember one time here, I was at some presentation on housing and they unfurled a, like, I swear it was like 9 feet long and a couple feet deep, list of the steps you had to go through in Austin through that discretionary process. And all of those are not just time and resources, but a lot of them are veto points too. So if you don't get through that, it can't happen. And I mean, Austin obviously had a historic, has had and continues to have to a degree, a historic housing crisis that luckily we're coming down from after some really aggressive policy change over the last year with the latest council. But it, I think for us, the release valve, like y'all actually, was neighboring communities. You know, people could, we had a lot of land, we had a lot of space, people could build out forever. In New York City, I mean, over the times I've gone, even watching the skyline across, it's the Hudson on that side between Jersey and New York City, right? Yeah. Across the Hudson, seeing that skyline change is remarkable. I mean, the amount of stuff they're building over there. But it is interesting because you're right, that kind of shrink wrap metaphor feels really appropriate. It's like it's just kind of frozen there, stuck down, and not a lot of change
Yeah.
comparatively to what you'd expect.
We also, are the amount that New York spends on building affordable housing and on subsidies is enormous. And again, so like we should be spending a lot of money on effective affordable housing programs, but the costs just keep going up and up and up. And the amount of money that we're spending because we're in this world of scarcity and we're all fighting over scarcity really does help contribute to these our subsidy dollars really not going nearly as far as they should. And what you said about veto points is so true. We also have just so many, it's opportunities for lawsuits, right?
Yeah.
Lawsuits by people that figure out how to weaponize the process. I mean, some of our members got their start in a project in Soho called Haven Green, which started over a decade ago and has been stuck in a lawsuit for so long, and it's still not through multiple lawsuits, and it's just a, there's a really like there's a huge human cost to this. The rates of homelessness in New York City, the number of kids in public schools that live in a homeless shelter, the inability, it what's interesting to be working on these issues in New York is there is such this identity. You could argue forever whether or not it was true or not, but such this identity that it's a place that is welcome to people from all over the world where you can really like go and sort of make yourself who you want to be. I think we're really our housing crisis is really risking that identity, or at least that aspiration in a really, really real way. I think another interesting thing about working on these issues in New York right now is we are very clearly losing population and losing electoral representation. And because of, cost of living, with housing being the biggest driver. So anyway, no, endless reasons of why it's in all of our interests to really tackle the housing crisis more aggressively.
Yes, watching that population decline and like you said, the resultant electoral cost as a Texan in Austin, I'm like, oh no, please. Usually on election night, it's like, save us, New York and California, you know, for some of us in Texas. And then watching that go away is just wild because it's a choice. Like you said, it's a choice
It's a choice.
that we've made.
Yeah. The author, Jerusalem Demsis, has done some just phenomenal writing about this. But it's 100% a choice, and also, it's both the moral imperative to be a place open to the people that are going increasingly already are, but increasingly going to get like persecuted in so many different directions. Is there's a moral imperative to make space for everybody right now, and also just this really. Just the math of it all, and this real reality that we're going to be in real trouble. The whole Democratic Party is going to be in real trouble if blue states become places that are just only for the wealthy.
For sure. And I think I loved what you said because this resonated a lot with what I feel and some of the things I've said here in Austin about whether it was ever true or not, you could argue, but there's this idea of New York City as again, I mean, think of like one of the more famous New York images, the Statue of Liberty and what's emblazoned on that pedestal, right? About give me your tired, your huddled masses, that whole beautiful poetic writing. And in a different way, Austin also had this kind of mythologized identity as somewhere that was environmentally friendly and laid back and welcoming and liberal and yada yada yada. But and again, like you said, you could argue whether that was ever actually an earned reputation. I would love to know if you feel this way with New York, but it almost feels like that is still a good thing for us to have now because it's something I point to and say that's what we could be. If that's our ideal, if our ideal is to be laid back, tolerant, loving, embracing, creative, like all the things Austin said it wanted to be, we have to find the way to get there. And the way to get there is not excluding people, especially the people who do creative work, right? Who need the more affordable housing stock. Similarly with New York, I mean, the people who are coming to New York as a refuge, literally for centuries now, you know, you exclude those people and therefore that whole dream of New York City when you allow the current status quo to continue and worsen. And that to me is, it's a tragic loss to this point, but it's a pivotal thing to use that image as a device to say, look, we're not being what we said we were. And that's an opportunity. And New York is very much, I think, for the rest of the country, this beacon, this thing. So I would love to get into City of Yes because I think this is one of those moments where it's like, oh my gosh, New York doing something really spectacular. And you mentioned that you were part of this kind of before it came to be in this iteration. Could you walk me through what happened, how we got here?
Yeah. So I think you saw in the last, you've seen a really rapid and clear and pretty dramatic shift in how people and people's definition of the problem in the housing crisis, and a recognition that the housing shortage and the need to build more housing needs to be part of the solution. And I think you see much more of a consensus around that than you did even a couple years ago. And again, we're the first ones to, we focus on zoning reform, we focus on building more homes. We're the first one to say that that doesn't solve all of your problems, but it has to be part of the mix, right? And it hasn't been to date. And also, we're going to go into City of Yes. It's exciting. It's the first big win. It's also still just like one relatively modest step of what we have to do, right? I think this is, you know, it's the foundation to build so much more on. But again, I think you saw, especially from the vantage point that I've been in a couple different seats now, I think you finally saw more of this recognition with the Soho rezoning, with the Gowanus rezoning, with the Fair Housing Plan coming out, that everywhere needs to do their part. And the fact that that Soho even did have even a small amount more housing built in terms of sort of the accountability of no, you don't, these like wealthy enclaves aren't off limits. Like this has to be politically possible. And the model that and a couple other projects around that time set helped build a lot of momentum for the type of larger reforms that are going to actually, like City of Yes, that are required so that we're not thinking that you can solve this like whack-a-mole site by site, project by project, right? And so you saw again, so you know, like Soho, NoHo, and Gowanus passed the very final city council meetings at the end of the de Blasio administration. And so you know, I stayed on into the administration at the very beginning, and there was a lot of momentum, and there were a lot more people being like, oh wow, there's okay, what might be the edge of politically possible now that those things passed? And also, frankly, the housing crisis itself was getting worse. And people like, you know, there is something to be said of just like we have more, and we have a, there's a an elected official, like the first Gen Z city council member himself looked for an apartment 2 years ago and documented the whole thing. And it really radicalizes you if you have to actually look for an apartment, which most elected officials don't actually have to do. And of course, that's the experience of just so many people, including so many of our own members, right? Like, you know, our membership skews younger, it skews renter, and Yeah, it's just people who are they're coming to this with their own experience. I think you also had a really phenomenal set of public servants on the staff side, saw the opportunity and were trying, okay, it's like how do we build a thoughtful approach? The head, for example, the head of city planning, Dan Garodnick, used to be a council member himself and could really think about, okay, how do you do this? How do you sequence a process to get to a bigger reform like this in a way that people can respect the process how you got there. You also saw the speaker of the city council herself lean in more to the fair housing angles of this. So she released a fair housing framework where you have that's trying to set targets for each district. They don't yet have the accountability to make sure that you can actually make sure that those places do get built. But all of this momentum and elected officials at all sides, and then at the state level, you had Kathy Hochul trying the housing compact. Again, it did not have a good enough campaign around it and didn't work, but you at least had this conversation that you didn't have before. And Open New York was just both our membership and our staff side work has been really, really instrumental in front of the scenes and behind the scenes and working a lot with reporters and press. And how do we think about this issue differently? And how do we find new ways to talk about this? I mean, for example, one way we frame this issue a lot is like your landlord should be worried that you can find another apartment. Like this is truly a sort of a tenant landlord power imbalance when you're fighting over scarcity like this. And I think that we were able to tap into a wider coalition than had existed previously, about how you really think about this as a tenants issue, about how you pair this with tenant protections as a smart set of policies. And especially in a place like New York City, which is majority renter, that really, really matters. And it really matters that you're getting a wider range of groups across the political spectrum, especially on the progressive side, sort of on board. So anyway, this has been, and then the actual process for City of Yes goes through the typical land use review process and take, I guess it was, a year and a half, no, 2.5 years. Oh, wow. 2.5 years since it was first announced, to officially go through a lot of the steps. And then it enters our official land use review process is a legally timed process, which is it's good that it has a legal clock on it, and goes through. So, we had our members, we have 51 council members here. We have so many community boards. And so we organized our members to be going to to just be present in every community board meeting, say, trying to sort of balance the voices that are often no on a lot of these things. The first citywide hearing over the summer, in front of the City Planning Commission, we organized our members, and it started at 10 a.m. and ended at 1 in the morning. We had our members. Our members were some of the last ones testifying. We live tweeted the whole thing if you want to go relive it yourself. But it actually was majority in support, and that was the first time I've ever seen that in my experience of this work. And we actually did it again in front of City Council, also a 15-hour hearing to just and we did a lot of polling throughout this process to really show 80% of people supported the set of policies. I mean, this is again like this is just actually pretty sensible stuff. And then I'll get into I can summarize sort of the substance of the proposal, but also just finishing the story of sort of the mayor was indicted in, the last 3 months of the process. And so I think this survived a lot of curveballs, and I give a huge amount of credit both to some of the really, really smart and savvy staff that figured out how to navigate, tricky political circumstances on the administration side, and also the speaker of the city council really decided and could have dropped this, but really decided it's like, no, we got to do something about housing. I'm gonna craft a whole plan to pair with this called City for All as a whole set of investments that are going to be part of this negotiation package, and really own that. No, we need to like we really need to do something on housing, and you saw a lot of council members really step up. And that was really, and so what you ended up with was a modified but still quite strong overall City of Yes zoning plan with what ended up being a $5 billion package of all sorts of different investments in affordable home ownership, in The affordable housing pipeline and staff for city agencies that have really been gutted, and a lot of programs that make sense to be paired for tenant protections and a lot of other things. And so, anyway, all of those are a lot of the highlights of exactly sort of how it played out. Like, since I skipped over this a bit, I'm happy to just walk through what's actually in City of Yes itself, which I think.
I would love that. Yeah, because and I would love if you could walk us through like what was the initial ask, and then what did we get? Because that's always such an interesting process to me of like what gets through to the finish line. Because you often know, I mean, when you're going in with a big ask, and this was a big ask, like you said, it's the first thing done in a while on housing. You come out with something slightly different, but hopefully still impactful. And y'all definitely did that. So what was the initial scope, and then how did we get it to something workable and passable?
So the initial scope, so this whole thing is called City of Yes for Housing Opportunity. The tagline was a little more housing in every neighborhood. So again, it's actually taking a citywide approach, which helps distribute some of like the political cost that often comes with approving housing. And for the first time in the city's history, actually took a look at the underlying zoning in every single district and made tweaks to the underlying zoning that could add housing in a way that made sense for that neighborhood. And so New York City being New York City, this included I mean, the entire range of neighborhoods, right? Of neighborhood types. So it became sort of this package of a bunch of different techniques that added up in their first initial estimate to between 100 and 110,000 homes over 15 years. And so the components of this, there was a component called what's called universal affordability preference. So it was basically a like allowing a new tool to allow buildings to add at least 20% more housing if the additional homes were affordable, again with certain affordability requirements. And so that this is like an as of right 20% bump in a huge swath of the city. There were some things about res making residential conversions of office buildings easier. There was, re-legalizing small and shared housing that actually used to be legal in New York City and then wasn't. And then when you go to some more of like sort of mid-density neighborhoods, you saw what is a mild but still good baseline as of right transit-oriented development. Which again, New York City has a lot of transit-oriented development, but when you go out to some of the more than people realize, there's a lot of swaths of New York City that are pretty low density. You saw sort of just like some really smart, how do you like legalizing housing on a, like a above a corner store in like a mid-density like district, right? There's just some really baseline stuff like that that frankly are just reflecting how New York City was built. Originally. And then you also saw, again, for the first time in New York City, I know this sounds like a shocker to a lot of people states that have already legalized this across their country, but legalized accessory dwelling units in low de in for as a homeowner option in low density districts. There are definitely other things built in there, but those are a lot of the big those are the big mo oh, and then eliminating parking mandates. The initial proposal was eliminating parking mandates citywide. So again, there's other stuff, but those are all of the big moves. Where we landed was approximately 80,000 homes, and the pieces that took so it is about 1,400 pages of zoning text, and we've been just diving through the details to really land on the big takeaways. But the biggest cuts came from we did not eliminate parking mandates citywide. It is a larger area than it was before. And again, it's such the sort of unsung hero of making it easier to build housing that that's still a really big deal. There were some cutbacks to where ADUs applied, and same with some cutbacks to some of the sort of transit-oriented development or lower rise sort of like corridor, small scale apartment buildings in certain corridors. And so I think that what we were always judging success on from the beginning here is, are you in total getting a large number of homes? And is everywhere part of the solution? You're not cutting out massive swaths of the city, which is both essential for building homes. It's also just really essential for the principle of how we need to be addressing the crisis. And we feel really good because we do, again, despite the cuts, despite a couple thing cuts that are like a little more painful than you want them to be, frankly, this really was the edge of what's politically possible. And that's a, it had so many moments where it could die as these things go, but especially in the twists and turns of New York City politics. And you did not see every component of the proposal was still intact, and you did not see huge cutouts in general. There are some small ones that we're digging into, but so, you know, writ large from those two principles that we really held strong, it's a huge success. And I think what's so exciting is you see, it passed 31 to 20, which is a pretty, it's quite tight margin for how things usually pass. And you just saw elected official, you saw council member after council member stand up and say, I'm pro housing. We have to build more homes. And in a way that you didn't see even a year ago. And the fact that you're, so we're doing so much work to try to really show it is good politics to have that stance where we're launching immediately into our endorsement process for every single council member coming up next year, which is exciting and a good opportunity to really model what it means to be pro-housing and to have it be good politics for you. But it's just a really important moment that we now have that foundational win and a lot of people realizing that you can say and vote for these things, and a lot of and people are going to see that, oh, you did something in the housing crisis. It's not everything. We have to do so much more, but it's really moving in the right direction.
You're right that it is different after one of these things happens, right? I mean, even your the opponents of what you're trying to pass feel different after this kind of thing. I remember watching one council member in particular when the hearings were happening just rail against people who weren't from the city. I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. They were very, very vocal person. And it almost seemed like, how is that an acceptable thing to say anymore? You know, when that was like kind of a disposition that was at least accepted as being around before you have a big housing win like this. And now it's like that's not tenable. You can't have that position and be on the right side of things anymore, right? It's a feeling of progress, of growth, of acceptance, of and to your immense credit, I mean, I think the work that y'all did citywide to have everyone do their part can be kind of rare. It can be hard to do. I mean, here in Austin, like the development burden has fallen on a couple areas a lot harder than a couple other areas. And you can imagine the demographic splits between those areas, right? And part of our current work is like, how do we prevent further displacement while still recognizing that we're a growing city? And I so admire that way to say everybody's got to do your part. There cannot, and it feels so properly New York. Like one of the things that I love when I go to the city is like, you don't get this kind of zoned and segregated sense as strongly as you do in other cities. Where like, oh, if I want to get something to eat, I have to go over there, and if I want to be where people live, it's over there. Similarly, I think that like that idea that every single part has to have all of these different things going on is wonderfully generative. And it sounds like your process really reflected that, which is great. I'm curious how y'all got that to happen. Like, what do you think were the driving forces that led to this? Was it just like price points got so high? Was there organizing? What was that like?
Yeah, I think, I mean, definitely just the people, you know, the cold hard facts of where rent is and people's experience trying to look for housing is, I mean, you know, makes this all the more real and is only getting so much worse. I think you also, I do think that Open New York has been really at the forefront of just like pushing this conversation and talking about it in new ways and getting more attention to how broken a lot of the processes are that have led us here. I think the actual also throughout City of Yes, there was a really broad coalition of over 150 groups. We were sort of on the steering committee, running a lot of parts of it behind the scenes, called the Yes to Housing Coalition. This had a bunch of labor unions, a lot of faith leaders. It's had a really, really wide range of housing advocates. It's had AARP that's been like really helpful in ADUs in other states. So, and this became a really central important fight that was getting a lot of attention. And also, frankly, you saw the council member you were talking about. Like some of the opponents here were not, you know, we're showing what you stand for if you're opposed to this in a way that you know is can be really helpful to really force an issue for people. And I think again you saw a huge reason this this passed. A lot of the votes you really really needed were almost in the all of the members of the Progressive Caucus, for example. You this is a huge credit to the speaker herself, but you saw a lot of opposition early on in Southeast Queens, and the speaker herself, the speaker's district herself was really challenging on a lot of these fronts. And where the votes ended up, you had all of Southeast Queens council members voting in support. And I think you also, you know, the actual the supplementary package, this whole sort of complementary agenda, this $5 billion, I think just also really helps make sure that people are seeing a wide range of investments in other types of programs and affordability that people really need to see. But again, the fact that this was like a zoning and like a yes and you and the fact that especially with some of the pretty ugly opposition that you saw, I think it reinforced even harder how much of a fair housing case this was. That everywhere's doing something, that you're looking at the citywide. And I think it started to really, really resonate with people that you just we have to build more homes and people have to have more options. And we gotta figure it out, right? And I think something that's also really positive coming out of this is part of some of the negotiations were places where, again, we it's really important to be talking this citywide with the underlying zoning. This doesn't displace the need for individual rezonings in different neighborhoods, for example. There's still a number of those going on that we're also doing a lot of organizing for. And but you saw a lot of council members actually ask for studies in their neighborhood. And so this is exactly what you need to see. It's like there's not this is tricky stuff to figure out, you know, like and so but even just the fact that you have a recognition, it's like, okay, we gotta add housing. How should we do it? Right? That's a different change. And again, I think Open New York gets a huge amount of credit that we're sort of organizing a whole grassroots base of people that just wasn't organized in this way before to really make visible what poll after poll shows that just this stuff is generally popular and some of the negative voices in your head, they're just not representative.
They can certainly haunt you when they're the only ones in the room, right? Yeah, so much of that work is wonderfully, I think, that getting people out to express the opinions they've held privately. Like, we have poll after poll after poll, like you mentioned, not just in New York, but all over the country. People support these kind of things. I'm not a big fan of like calling things common sense measures because I think it's kind of, it hides a lot of things, but that's about as close as you get. Like, you're getting 75 plus percent margins on ADUs and things like that everywhere, you know? And you can go to a city council meeting or a planning commission meeting or whatever it is, and you think, my God, everyone here just hates housing. Because the loud voices for the longest time have been very against. That's changing. I mean, thanks to the work that groups like Open New York and otherwise in other communities are doing to get people's voices heard that hadn't been as part of that process, right? And that's so critical. It's so heartening every time I see one of those polls too, because it feels like maybe that the last 15 polls were lying. Maybe people actually do hate this. And then you see it and you're like, no, they don't. It's just people are busy. People don't have time to fight, nor do we should we expect everyone to have an understanding of the planning process when it's this complicated, right? To know when to show up to advocate for something new is hard. So that work is critical, really critical. And it's really cool to see it like scale up to something as comprehensive as City of Yes. Parking is such a funny thing too. You mentioned the parking mandates. Like, we got rid of parking mandates totally here in Austin earlier this year. And when I was watching some of the hearings on the City of Yes, parking kept coming up like a disproportionate amount, I feel like, given the whole package of ideas being discussed. And it was kind of shocking to hear people in New York City talk about being in transit deserts comparatively. I'm like, oh my God, I would kill to be at the end of your transit desert, you know? not to fail to empathize with the scarcity of transit in some parts of the city, but it really was remarkable. But huge things got passed, and that is so wonderful. What does implementing a big agenda look like like this look like for y'all? Like, are y'all engaging with the departments that have to follow through on this kind of stuff, or is it pretty good faith that it's going to happen as planned?
I mean, so the anything that's in the zoning is, is the new zoning, right? So that that's immediate. There's a whole slew of commitments that will that require that require a lot of different arms of government to follow up. I think, frankly, every rezoning has some sort of agreement on commitments like this, so it's not new that it's like, okay, like that commitment came from this, this deal many years ago. What's happening on that now? And so I think it's something that we and a lot of groups are used to, but a lot of the commitments and a lot of the and the scale is a lot larger on this. So I think it's going to be, it's going to be a number of years of making sure all of those other pieces are in the works. Especially things like public sector capacity and hiring. They're so important, but you also need the right people in the right seats and the right leadership to be doing that work, really effectively. So yeah, it will be a continued push, but the zoning itself is immediate, which is really exciting.
And what is next for y'all? Besides the endorsements, which you mentioned are coming up, which is critical, what's the next policy thing for y'all?
So we're having a big party tomorrow, so definitely making sure to take some pause and just celebrate all the work. On the city level, we're definitely, immediately moving into our endorsement and electoral process. We also actually launched last year, we launched an electoral arm of our organization, an independent expenditure committee, to be able to put more resources in new ways behind candidates we endorse, and just really help put, help show this can be good politics. So we're very excited to dive into all of that. There are a lot of local projects and rezoning still happening. We are immediately moving right into our state legislative session. And so our relatively small team does both city and state work. So we're keeping ourselves busy. But we have a, I think, what City of Yes just did in New York City, again, there's still so much more to do even in New York City, but the model of just making a lot more sensible growth as of right in ways that make sense for other places or having some sort of accountability, it has we have yet to get close to that at the state level. And frankly, 2 years ago with the Housing Compact was even the first time we were even having that conversation. So we're learning a lot about how Albany works, and we introduced a bill last year that we're to have an expanded and growing coalition for and are going to be back this year with, called the Faith-Based Affordable Housing Act. It's passed in a couple other states known as Yes in God's Backyard or YGBY, where it's the state directly legalizing land owned by faith-based organizations and empowering them to build housing in their own communities. And so we're working with a large coalition of faith leaders who, some of them have built a affordable housing project on their parking lot and it took a decade and they're like, this should be faster. Others were working with one a pastor upstate who actually was trying to build housing on extra land they had and got downzoned in the dead of night and are now sort of figuring out if you have a lawsuit. Like really crazy stuff because you leave New York City and there's no as of right process at all. So that's a bill that we're really excited about. It got it got really far for a first year bill last year. If it passes, when it passes, it will be the first pro housing bill in Albany, which is really exciting. But Albany is historically a it is not known to be the easiest place to get a lot of stuff passed. So we're learning a lot really, really quickly, which is exciting. But we'll be up there again in Albany for that. And then again, we see that as really the foundation to jumpstart the state level conversation to be able to introduce more and bigger and broader bills and more and bigger and broader coalitions to really start to get a lot more movement on the state level as well.
Yeah, I have dreams of an abundant New York for sure.
Very much
It's going
so.
to be beautiful. It's going to be beautiful. Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share about your work, about City of Yes, about what's going on in Albany, anything?
Yeah, I really just think actually someone asked me recently like where I feel hope and inspiration, and I really do. My answer was our members, and I do think that just the Especially these days with what's going on in the country and the world, I think there is so much, there's actually so much, the ticket on these issues are state and local, and especially, and state is local, right? So like local organizing around these issues is the way you start to move that. And it's really, I feel really honored to be in a position with some small amount of agency to try to organize folks around this and try to make a difference. And I think going forward, it's just such an important thing to remember, you know, that we're not powerless, and that the this work with it relatively small numbers of people can move the needle, and just really encourage folks to get more and more involved. And I think it's, you know, it's also just, it's fun and it really matters. And I think it's just been really exciting to be part of that, you know, that grassroots organizing work, and figure out how to bring my skill set from before and build up other skill sets to just be turbocharging all this work and elevating those voices, and frankly making it so that we don't have to fight every single project. You know, that's actually the goal, that you don't need to spend hours and hours of your night to just get a you know, some basic more housing options down the street. But it's just been a real honor to get to do this work, and I think it feels even more important with what's going on in our country right now.
I agree. And I am deeply thankful for your work, for all your team, and for leading the good fight. You're an example to the rest of us, so I appreciate you.
Thank you. And of course, big shout out to the Welcoming Neighbors Network, and just to the network that has been so huge in you know, learning from each other and comparing notes. And I'm not feeling alone as we go through our process in New York.
Yeah, we're very lucky to have each other for sure. So much good in that room. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the stoop. I am so grateful. Please pass my regards on to your whole team, and we'll talk soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Anne Marie isn't taking this win for granted. As you could hear, there's a lot more to do, and the Open New York team is getting to work right away doing it. You can find Anne Marie on social media. She's at Anne Marie Gray. That's AnnEMarie, Gray on Twitter, and at AnneMarieGray.bsky.social on Blue Sky. You can also find Open New York online at opennewyork.org or on social media at OpenNY for all. That's Open NYFORALL on Twitter and Instagram, and at opennewyork.org on Blue Sky. As always, you can connect with the Welcoming Neighbors Network online at welcomingneighbors.us and on social media. We are at WNN Pro Housing on Instagram and Twitter, and at welcomingneighbors.us on Blue Sky. This is our final episode for 2024. We'll be on a brief break for the holidays, but we'll be back with even more stories about the fight for abundant housing across the United States in early 2025. I'll certainly miss you, but we'll be together again before we know it. The Stoop is produced in-house at the Welcoming Neighbors Network by me, Cutter Gonzalez. The music for our show is created by my friend Nolan Hopkins. If you have ideas for our show, including special episodes, guests you'd like to hear from, or topics you'd like to cover, shoot me an email at cutter@welcomingneighbors.us or DM me on social media. My handle is at CutterWGonzalez with a Z across all platforms. Thanks so much for joining us. Talk to y'all real soon.